Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, an incredible story with so many twists and turns, it would seem to have come from a writer of fiction. But this is a true story that the author describes in the introduction as involving a shipwreck some 211 years ago, British and Americans meeting under the most stressful circumstances in a time of war, kindness and compassion, drunkenness, the birth of a child, treachery, greed, lying, a hostile takeover, stellar leadership, ingenuity, the value of a good dog, perseverance, endurance, threats, bullying, banishment, a perilous 1,000-mile open ocean journey, an improbable rescue mission in a rickety ship, and legal battles over a dubious and disgraceful wartime prize. Eric J. Dolan talks about his new book, Left for Dead, Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World. Welcome back, Eric.
Thanks for having me back.
What a tale.
and what a sentence.
I know,
having
right?
Having you read my sentence back to me. Wow, that was long.
You know, and this is such a wild story. This is a story that isn't really found in any history books. None of the characters are particularly noteworthy in historical terms. So how did you come across this?
Well, you know, coming up with a book topic is always difficult. Oftentimes I figure out a topic based on something I've recently written. But for this book, I went to a book that was published in the 1980s with the rough title. It was a history of shipwrecks and disasters from 1580 to 1860. And what it is basically a compilation. Each disaster or shipwreck gets one paragraph. And then beneath it, the author, who was a professor, listed the primary source materials that were written about this event. So I came upon this paragraph about this guy, Charles H. Barnard, a sealing captain from Hudson, New York. Actually, originally, you know, he was born in Nantucket, but he left for Hudson, New York. And I was reading this paragraph simply said that he and four other men were intentionally marooned on the Falkland Islands during the War of 1812 for about 18 months. And that just got my attention. And right beneath it, there was a listing of a book that this guy Barnard wrote in 1829 about his experience. So I got it. I read the book and I said, this is a wild story. And then I had to start looking around to make sure that there was other material upon which to build a fuller account of what happened. And fortunately for me, there was. It was just an absolutely amazing story. These three threads coming together, these three ships coming to the Falkland Islands roughly at the same time in a certain sequence. You had the American sealing vessel, you had a shipwrecked British brig, and then you had a British warship that came later. And it just, the twists and turns and the decisions that were made at various points, and also learning about the Falkland Islands, which are just gorgeous and have a fascinating history. They're another character in the book. So it was, yeah, it was a lot of fun writing this book.
All right. So before we board the Nanina, set the scene for us. It's 1812, but just before war begins between the United States and Britain, but there was war waging between Britain and France. So set the scene for us. What was happening?
Right. Britain and France have been at war, the Napoleonic Wars, for quite some time, and America had been drawn into it, the United States, because of a couple of reasons, one of the foremost of which was the practice of impressment on the part of the British. The British Navy was very large, therefore it needed a lot of sailors to fit out its fleet. So what they tended to do, and they started doing this in the late 1700s, and they did it all the way up until 1812, they would stop American ships, board the ships forcibly, and then they would take sailors who they claimed were actually British citizens, take them off the ship, put them on the British warship, and force them to become part of the British Navy. Now, the problem was, although a few of those sailors may in fact have been deserters from the British Navy, most of them were actually American citizens. And this really got American politicians and American citizens upset. And that was one of the reasons leading up to the war. Another one was that Britain and France didn't want the United States to be providing succor to the enemy. So British ships were attacking American merchant ships that were going to French ports or other places in the continent. And French ships were attacking American ships who they suspected of helping out the British with goods. So it was really a very dicey situation for the United States. They wanted to avoid war. They tried to avoid war, but ultimately there was a vote taken to launch the war. But while this was all going on, Charles Barnard, the captain of the sealer, and John Murray and Son, the owners of the vessel, they wanted to send out a sealing venture to the Falkland Islands. And the purpose of that sealing venture is to kill seals, fur seals, and sea lions, strip them of their pelts, then process the pelts in the Falkland Islands, then travel around Cape Horn, go to Canton, China, which is now Guangzhou, China, and sell those pelts for anywhere from 35 cents a piece to up to $5. And this industry was quite large. They had killed, before the War of 1812, probably in the order of 2.5 million seals, not just Americans, but other countries as well. So you have this sealing venture. Another thing they wanted to do, which has some echoes of the whaling history that's so important on the Cape and the islands, is that they also wanted to slaughter sea elephants who had very thick blubber. And when you melted down that blubber, you would get an oil that was a very good illuminant, almost as good as spermaceti oil. So that was another purpose of these sealing ventures. So Charles Barnard and the owners, John Murray and Son, want to get a sealing venture off the ground. And they're putting it together right at the time that Congress and the president is considering placing an embargo on any travel from American ports, the purpose being to give enough time, 60 or 90 days, so that all the ships that are out at sea can come back to their United States port and not be caught in this war. So Barnard and John Murray and Sons are paying attention to what's happening in Washington, D.C. And when they hear that the embargo is ready to be handed down, they quickly send the Nanina offshore, off Sandy Hook, New Jersey, so that it wouldn't be captured once they closed down the port of New York, because they were leaving from New York Harbor. And they weren't the only ones that had this idea. They were joined off of Sandy Hook, New Jersey, by 70 other ships who were hoping to beat the embargo. So that is the setting. They leave and right as the embargo is being laid down, but war hasn't been declared yet.
And now this is sort of an unusual crew in that there's more than one captain aboard.
Yes, because of the Napoleonic Wars and because of actually a diminution of the number of seals, sealing ventures from the United States had been few and far between in the years leading up to the War of 1812. And then you add in the war itself, that was causing a lot of American merchants to keep their ships in port. So there were a lot of unemployed sealers and a lot of unemployed captains of sealing vessels. So when Charles Barnard looked around for the other 12 people to fill out his crew, essentially, he tapped four other captains because they were unemployed. They needed something to do. And they also invested, they put up a $5,000 bond each to ensure the voyage itself. So he had these other captains, and one of the captains was his father, Valentine Barnard, who was 63 years old and was going to be entrusted with, once they go down to the Falkland Islands, they fill up with a number of seal skins and oil. They were going to send the Nanina back to New York to deliver all that cargo. Valentine was going to be the captain or master of that voyage, and they were going to leave behind the rest of the sealing crew in the Falklands to continue sealing. And then Valentine was going to come back down with the empty ship, pick up everybody, pick up all their pelts and oil, and then go straight to China.
Sounds like a good plan. But so describe what the Falklands were like at this time and what the crew of the Nanina might encounter.
The Falklands are an archipelago of about 700 islands, but if you only count the islands that are visible at high tide, it's probably about 200 islands. The landmass of the Falklands is about equivalent to the state of Connecticut, and the Falklands are about 300 miles to the east of the Strait of Magellan at the southern tip of South America. There are no trees in the Falklands. It's a very forbidding environment. A lot of people who visited there had nothing nice to say about it. In the summer months, the average temperature is 49 degrees, and in the winter months, the average temperature is 36 degrees. But you have to plug into that equation that the average wind speed year round is 18 miles per hour. So when you add the wind speed to that temperature, 36 degree temperature plummets down to the upper 20s. So it was a very cold place. There was no shelter. There were no trees. There were these things called tussock grass, which are large, up to 9 foot tall, sort of ornamental. They're not ornamental, but you can think of them as ornamental grasses that you might have in your garden. And there was only one mammal that lived on land, a terrestrial mammal, a wora, which is a fox essentially, but it was hunted to extinction in the 1860s. And then, of course, you had all these seals and you had sea elephants and you had a lot of whales around the island and there were lots of birds. And there are also hogs because these islands had been used for many, many decades by hunters from different countries who were pursuing seals and also whaling. Ships would stop off in the Falklands because there are thousands of r lakes, ponds, and rivers, so they could replenish their fresh water. But what those whalers used to do, and those older sealers used to do, is they would leave hogs on some of the Falkland Islands, enough of them so they could breed, because they wanted to create an endemic, not a native, but they wanted to create a herd of hogs essentially. That anybody that comes to the Falklands could use as a source of food. And those hogs were indeed on the Falkland Islands when the Nenina arrived, but there was nobody else on the Falkland Islands when the Nenina arrived in September of 1812. They had already been under dispute, the islands, the ownership of the islands between the French, the British, and the Spanish. And at various times in the 1700s and up until the early 1800s, there had been settlements, French, Spanish, and British settlements. But by the time the Nenina arrives, everybody has vacated.
So Captain Barnard, he's a complicated man. There were complaints from his crew. I mean, later in the story, we see he shows great compassion, but a little bit of a hothead, maybe.
Yeah, oh, he was definitely a hothead. I mean, it was compounded by the fact that on the way down, he apparently had these very bad sores on his legs, which made his temper even worse. But there's no doubt that he was the only one on board the Nenina who was causing a lot of trouble. He was arguing with the other captains. Now, you have to admit that anytime you have more than one captain or one person on a ship who's used to being a captain and having his orders followed, you're asking for trouble. But there's no doubt, based on the perception of multiple people involved, that Charles Barnard was creating almost all the problems. He seemed to be a very arrogant man. He was a very large man. He was a very powerful man, and he took offense at many things, one of which was that one of the other captains was spreading rumors that Charles Barnard was not welcome at the Tontine Coffee House in New York City, which was a famous watering hole for merchants and captains of vessels. So he demanded from this other captain that he tell him, who started this rumor, where'd it come from? And he was really upset about that. So they almost got into a fight. But things settled down, as you said, a few months after they got to the Falkland Islands, because at one point, Barnard threatened to leave. And the other captains threatened never to work with him again. And Valentine, Barnard's father, stepped in as a peace negotiator, and he was able to broker a ceasefire essentially. And from there on out, the group seemed to get along fairly well.
So they get along fairly well. Now we're going to take a bit of a detour here and move on to the Isabella. All right, so the Isabella, who was aboard? Where was she headed? And she sinks also in the Falklands.
The Isabella was a merchant brig that was leaving from what is now Sydney Harbor, Port Jackson back then, and it had 54 individuals on board. Many of them were the crew. There were 14 Royal Marines, armed Royal Marines, plus their captain. There were a number of other passengers that had paid for their trip from Australia to London. They were ultimately heading to London. But there were also 10 former convicts on board because, as everybody probably knows, Australia was established as a English penal colony. So a lot of the early residents were convicted of crimes in England and were sent to Australia. So 10 of the people on board had either served out their sentence or had been pardoned. And they were at one time convicts. And four of the women were almost certainly former prostitutes. They were referred to that in that way by people that were on the voyage. And
And we had one
from what
pregnant
I
lady.
one pregnant lady, yeah. Well, the captain of the Marines, a guy named Robert Durie, his wife, Joanna Ann Durie, was very pregnant when they took off. I guess they assumed that she would have the child on board, but they head out from Australia in the summer and late summer, they almost crash off of Campbell Island, which is still in the Pacific Ocean on the way to Cape Horn, because Captain George Higdon is essentially incompetent. He's also a drunkard. And so they almost crashed. They make it around Cape Horn, which was a very tempestuous part of the journey. And then their plan was not to go straight to London because they were running low on food and water, but they decided to go to Rio de Janeiro. They had thought briefly about going to the Falklands, but they thought better of it because they didn't have any maps of the Falklands. So they decided to go to Rio de Janeiro. But again, because of George Higdon's incompetence, they found themselves coming right onto the Falkland Islands, right onto Eagle Island, one of the islands, and they crashed into a reef offshore, less than a mile offshore, and then sort of bounced in closer to shore. The Isabella was a complete wreck. Amazingly, all 54 people on board made it ashore, but there are a lot of funny stories and actually disturbing stories about their journey to land, and they created this new encampment, and this is in early February of 1813, called Newtown Providence. And within a couple of weeks, Joanna Ann Durie has her baby, and probably the first person, one of the first people ever born on the Falklands. And so it's fascinating. They're there on February. The sealers from the Nanina are already there. They don't know. Both of these groups don't know about each other. But then a couple of months later, in April, Charles Barnard and a few of the other men are on a sealing voyage in the Young Nanina, which is sort of a smaller boat that they put together when they came to the Falklands that was used to go on these hunting forays. And they're in Falkland Sound and they see fire coming from Eagle Island. And they go to investigate and then they discover this group of 54 castaways from the Isabella. And that's sort of the next part of the story.
Yeah, and the next part, we're talking about the book Left for Dead: Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World. The author is Eric J. Dolan, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Eric J. Dolan about his new book, Left for Dead: Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World. So you mentioned the Nanina, they're doing their sealing, and then you have the Isabella. They crashed. They see the smoke. They go to investigate. But before that happens, they decided, after the Isabella crashed, they decided that six men would set off in what, a 17.5-foot longboat to look for help, right? So they've gone off.
Yeah, they've gone off. They went off at the end of February, and their goal initially was to sort of sail around the Falkland Islands to see if there are any British or Spanish settlements. They were not aware that actually the Falklands, all the those different countries and their settlements had been disbanded. But if they didn't find anybody, which they didn't, then they were supposed to attempt the very perilous journey of about 1,200 miles from the Falklands up to Montevideo, which is now in Uruguay, to get help, because there were British naval ships in various ports of South America, including Montevideo, Buenos Aires, and Rio de Janeiro. So that was their goal. They went off And that's an interesting story in and of
Yeah,
itself.
that's what I said. There's all these twists and turns and other stories. So the passengers of the Isabella don't know that war has broken out between Britain and America, but
Yes.
Captain Barnard does. And so talk a little bit about, I mean, they raise the flag and they see the passengers, yay, they're here. And they go, uh-oh. So he makes a deal. Tell us about the deal.
Yes. Barnard, when he left New York, he didn't, the war hadn't broken out. But what happened is a ship, the Hope, actually came to the Falklands in early 1813, told Barnard and the rest of them that war had broken out. So he knew it. He sees these castaways. He and the other captains decide to do what is a humanitarian gesture. They agree to rescue the castaways, take them back to a port in South America, or even possibly in the United States so they could ultimately make it to London. But Barnard knows by talking to them that they don't know that the war has broken out. In fact, when the young Nanina is coasting along the shore and the castaways are jumping up and down on the shore, they discover that they're Americans and they're going, yay, yay, Americans, you know, we're friends now. And because there were two British Marines that Barnard saw, and he was relieved by that. But then after they offer this deal, or right when they're offering this deal, at first Barnard didn't want them to know that the war had broken out because he didn't know how they would react. And there were 54 of them plus 14 armed Royal Marines. The British could have easily overpowered the 13 American sealers. And there were even fewer of them at this time because they were in the young Nanina. So Barnard's a little bit worried, but he decides in the end, before inking this deal where they're going to save the castaways in exchange for all the cargo on the Isabella and anything they could salvage from the Isabella, minus personal effects, before he inks this deal, he calls aside some of the leaders of the castaways and tells them the war has broken out. And despite that, only a couple of people out of the 54 balk at that moment, one of whom wants to take, you know, overpower the Americans. But the rest of them say, no, no, this is great. You're doing the right thing. This is a humanitarian gesture. Even though it's a time of war, even though we're officially enemies, we agree to this deal. Thank you.
Yeah.
And Barnard and about 20 or so of the castaways, plus some of his men, go back to where they're holed up about 110 miles away in another harbor. And they leave behind a couple of the captains and they're preparing to go. And then the next twist of the story happens.
And unbeknownst to the castaways is that the Nancy is on its way and the captain has plans to take the Nanina as a war prize.
Right. Well, what happens is the HMS Nancy, a British warship, that 17 and a half foot boat that the castaways had sent off was
made
successful.
It. They made it.
And it made it. And the British in turn sent a British warship to rescue the castaways. But when Captain Deranda got there, he was immediately told of the Americans' presence because there were a couple of Americans in Newtown Providence in the camp. He knew of the Americans and he knew of the deal that had been reached, but he ripped up the deal and he said, I don't care. It's time of war. These Americans and their ships, the young Nanina and the Nanina, are prizes of war. And none of the castaways really spoke up, even though they all, or a lot of them, thought this was a horrible thing to do to these Americans who had offered to help us, had done the right thing. So there's Deranda, because he realizes during a time of war, if he brings in a prize and it's counted as a legitimate prize, he gets the proceeds from the sale of the ship, the Nanina, and all of its cargo. So that creates a real potential conflict. But in the meantime, and I'm probably going to go to this next, is you've got Barnard and his buddies preparing the Nanina to go back to Eagle Island, where they assume the castaways are waiting for them to pick them up and save them. Right. They have no idea that a British warship has arrived, but there are even more problems in going from where the Nanina is to Eagle Island that have nothing to do with the British warship.
Yeah, so Captain Barnard and three others are at Beaver Island seal hunting. They decide to go seal hunting right when the Nanina is forced to sail to the wreck site of the Isabella. So tell us about that. And those four are essentially just left behind. Winter weather, sure to die.
Right. So what happens is Barnard and everybody else, they're readying the Nanina for sailing and they're running out of food. So Barnard takes four other people, so it's a total of five.
Five, okay.
And he says, I'm going to take a little trip and I'm going to go to Beaver Island, which is less than 10 miles away. And I'm going to kill some hogs and some birds and stuff and bring back food for the people who are fast running out of money. Another humanitarian gesture. Right before he goes, the British raise up and they say, no, you must go to Eagle Island right now. We've got to get back there. And it's not clear what they were going to do once they got there because they didn't know about the British warship either. But they wanted to leave right away. Barnard settled them down, says, no, I just need to go for a couple of days and get food. We need food. The weather's really bad. We don't want to leave yet. So he goes off on this hunting trip. And then 2 days later, the British rise up again and say, we don't care. We're going. Valentine pleads with them to not leave because his son and these four other men, three British, two Americans, including Barnard, are away hunting. They'll be back in less than a day. Once they get back, we can go. The British said, no way. So one of the captains, the American captains, realizes that these British individuals know nothing about the Falklands or how to navigate through the treacherous waters. So he strikes a deal. He says, I will helm the ship. I will lead it through these treacherous waters if you stop at Beaver Island and pick up the hunting party. They agree. The ship leaves, goes to Beaver Island, and they renege on the deal. The British, instead of stopping and making a search and really a full-hearted effort to get the hunting party, all they do is they shoot the gun twice and then they sail off. And the Americans are seething, but they can't do anything. And then the Nanina comes to Eagle Island. And two things happened. First, the young Nanina, the smaller boat, had already gone in advance. And they've been captured by Duranda, the British captain, and they've been told that they're prisoners of war. And they told Duranda that the Nanina was coming soon. It took quite a while, so Duranda got very concerned. But then finally, the Nanina, here comes the Nanina. Nobody on the Nanina knows about the British warship. Well, the British Marines and soldiers jump on the Nanina, take it for Britain, separate the British people on board from the Americans. All the Americans are made prisoners of war, and then they start readying to leave the Falklands, knowing full well that those five hunters are about, it's probably about 80 miles away on another island. And the Americans plead with Duranda, please go pick up the five hunters. After all, three of them are British.
Yeah.
But Duranda refuses for quite some time. And then finally, when he sends a rescue effort, it's a half-hearted one. It barely makes it 20 miles and then turns around and comes back. It's barely gone for 3 days and just goes across Falkland Sound. And I'm convinced, even though I don't have proof of it, that he basically told these guys just do a half-hearted
Yeah.
search. And so then we get to the point when the Nanina and the HMS Nancy are readying to leave the Falklands. Again, once again, they could have gone by Beaver Island. They could have picked up those hunters, but
They
that was
didn't.
not even on his
So
mind.
here we have poor Captain Barnard and the other men. They're doing the hunting. They come back and they're like, "What? Where's the Nanina?" Right? And they're
Oh, yeah.
totally perplexed as to what's going on. I mean, their survival chances look pretty bleak. But boy, that Captain Barnard's he's a quite an interesting fellow. He's got some great survival instincts.
Yeah, he's been a captain for quite some time. He knew the Falklands. He had been there before, and he was a very resourceful man. So what the five men decide to do, first they come back to New Island, where it was the last place that the Nanina was, and it's not there. They're totally flummoxed and they're very concerned. They say, oh, it must have gone to Beaver Island to pick us up, but it went on the opposite side of where we were. So let's go back there. So they go back to Beaver Island. They're not there either. Now they're in real trouble. They decide that they have to try to make it in this little, it's essentially a whaleboat that they're in, a jolly boat. It's not very big. They decide that they have to make it all the way to Eagle Island to find out what's going on. They don't know what's going on. So this is in the depth of winter. They start sailing. They have this good plan, but the problem is the Falklands are very difficult to navigate through if you are not 100% familiar with all the different islands. It starts to look a little bit alike. So Barnard, who was quite familiar and wrote one of and produced one of the first maps of the Falkland Islands, he still gets lost. And for many weeks, they're going from place to place and they suddenly realize they don't know where they are. They're getting emaciated. They go back to their starting point, or essentially their starting point, almost dead. And then they decide, we've got to try again. And this time they do their original plan, which is to go down this little harbor, go over a little mountain, go into another harbor, and come out on the other side of West Falkland Island. It almost works, but the problem is, right when they're at the head of that other harbor, the men are so tired, it's so cold that only one of them, or two of them essentially, are willing to even try to go on. So they have to call it a day. They go back to Swan Island, which is near Beaver Island and New Island, and they vow to, maybe try again someday. But this is the start of their being left alone on the Falklands. And ultimately, they're there for 534
They
days.
have to
And they
survive. Yeah. So
have to survive. And a lot of things happen. I mean, they made all their clothes out of seal skins eventually. They didn't really like eating seal meat, which I wasn't quite sure about, because there were a fair number of seals, but actually sometimes the seals weren't there, and they're not on all islands, so they're not as plentiful as you might think. However, they did kill a lot of hogs, and for this they have to thank Scent,
the dog.
Barnard's dog, Scent. We don't know what kind of breed it was, but Barnard praises him up and down. He said basically, without Scent, who was very active in all of the hog hunts, and they really liked eating hog meat. And these hogs and these pigs or boars, whatever you want to call them, are big. And they have very sharp tusks coming out of their mouths. And Scent would clamp onto them and allow one of the men to come closer with a club or a knife and dispatch the animal. But in doing that, in going in first, Scent put himself in the path of danger. And actually, he had his groin gored, and he had one of his eyes plucked out by a tusk, and yet he kept doing it. And not only was he important for the hunting, as anybody who owns a dog knows, he was wonderful for their companionship and their spirits.
And I imagine cuddling with the dog kept you a little bit warmer.
Yes, right. Yeah, they would cuddle with the dog. Yeah, but just imagine all those days there through the winter, winters and summers, when it's always basically cold
Cold
or
all the
chilly,
time,
sometimes
yeah.
downright cold or chilly. You're eating the same food over and over again. Fortunately, there were penguin, there were rockhopper penguin rookeries nearby, and there were also black-browed albatrosses. Actually, the Falklands is the l largest population of black browed albatrosses in the world. It was then, and it certainly is now. And they lay eggs during certain times of year. So the men were able to collect eggs and eat them. The problem is the albatross eggs would go bad quickly, but the penguin eggs, if you rotated them and flipped them over, they could last for months.
Yeah,
But
amazing.
I imagine they got tired
Of all
just
of it,
eating
yeah.
eggs.
Yeah, we're talking with Eric J. Dolan. His book is Left for Dead: Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World. And we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Eric J. Dolan about his new book, Left for Dead: Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World. Now, at one point here, one of the men, one of the British men, he decides he's either going to trick Charles. He goes off for a hunt with Charles, and as Charles is going through that tussock grass you're talking about, he turns around. Ansel isn't there, and they were going to look for sea lions. And you write, so he turns around, he's gone. You write, a combination of panic and anger swept over him, fearing some treachery. Charles quickly retraced his steps. When he rounded the hill, he could see the boat pushing off from the beach with all the men on board. They had taken everything with them, including his dog.
Yeah, I can you imagine
No.
the feeling in the pit of your stomach when that happens? And so he was suddenly left alone. They took his flints. He had a knife with him. He had a couple of clubs. He had some clothes on, but they took basically everything else. They left the fire burning, which was important because he knew that if that fire went out, he'd be in big trouble. So he quickly got vines and driftwood and all sorts of other stuff to keep the fire going. And in the subsequent days, as he became, as he said, a real life Robinson Crusoe, he was able to, using his knife, using the butt of his knife or the back of his knife blade, he actually found some stones on the beach that, we don't know exactly what kind of stones they were, but they weren't probably flints, but they were able to generate a spark. And with that, he suddenly had a means of actually igniting a flame. And then a little while later, he discovered that these tussock grass, which can grow to 9 feet tall and live for 200 years, have beneath them an accumulation of peat, which is basically dirt and organic matter that can burn. And they do it in England, like in the heath bogs or whatever. And so he discovered that this, because he saw some of them were burned out. The Spanish used to come to the islands and sometimes burn areas to ward off sealers and other people from coming. So he discovers that this peat can burn almost as well as coal. So now he's got an unlimited source of fuel, and he keeps his fire going. He builds a small shelter. And he's there for a couple of months, and finally they come back. And the thing that's so frustrating is nobody gives him a very good reason other than the fact that Samuel Ansell, one of the British crewmen on the Isabella, who already had a really bad reputation as being a bully, for whatever reason, there may be multiple reasons, but he decided he was the instigator of this. And they come back and they want forgiveness from Charles Barnard. And he's in an interesting situation. He's alone. He's a religious man. He's a Quaker. He wants to turn the other cheek. He also liked companionship. He didn't like being alone. He wanted his dog back. So he said, just give me my, fine. If you don't want to come ashore, give me my dog. And then it was Ansell, who he later found out had the most to apologize for being the instigator of this departure. Finally, he says, you guys can come. I'm not going to have any retribution. I'm not going to get upset. Let's just not talk about it anymore. And they come ashore, and now they're a unit again. And over time, Barnard finds out that Ansell was this really horrible character and a bully. And the other men don't like being bullied by him. So at one point, they maroon Ansell. They use this sort of trick to get him to Swan Island, where the three men, Barnard is back on New Island. The three men say, we're going to go on a hunting trip and collect some driftwood. But essentially, they ask Ansell to do something to go get some driftwood. And while he's doing that, they hop back in the boat and they go back to New Island and they leave him stranded there. And then there are a couple of months where they provided Ansell with food. He was sort of a skeletal-like figure. At one point, they let him come back. And finally, he proved himself. He behaved better, and they were once again a unit for many more months.
I
So
guess
it,
yes, I guess there's nothing like leaving you on an island with nothing that's going to make you maybe change your bullying ways, right?
yes, yeah. And I think Barnard really has this great observation about bullies, how bullies are big and tough and threatening when they have the upper hand. But as soon as somebody stands up to a bully, they wither and die. And that it's really true, at least in my experience.
And it's interesting, of all the trouble that Ansell caused, Captain Barnard, it eventually they really become more friendly. He teaches him to read. They really
Yes.
bond quite a friendship in the end.
Yes, and which we'll get to that in the end. It's very important that they do that because later on in the story, Barnard sort of has Ansel's life in his hands. But yes, Barnard teaches him how to read. They discover that Ansel was probably a deserter from a British naval ship, so his name wasn't even Ansel.
And at one point, when he thought he was going to die, he sort of spilled the beans about not only his real name, but also that he was in on the plot. He was in on the British plot to take over the Nanina. And he just got, it was bad timing that he went off with the hunting party, and he was shocked that they still left him behind. But he was in on the plotting. So that's a lot to swallow and still accept a person and not want to wring his neck.
So they are finally rescued. And talk a little bit about the rescue. It's like after, I mean, how many days was it? I can't remember now. It's like a lot, yeah, a
534
long time.
days,
And
they're
whoo,
there.
two ships.
Yeah,
Two, not one,
two
two.
ships, but it's two whaling ships, the Asp and the Indispensable. And this is towards the end of 1814. The War of 1812 is still going on. And the whaling ships, they were just in the Falklands to do what many whaling ships in prior years had done. They wanted to pick up some food and water. But then they see two men on shore waving to them. Now, this is New Ireland that they're off of. Barnard and two other men are on Beaver Island, a short while away. They're doing some hunting. So the captains of the Asp and the Indispensable pick up these two men on shore. They tell their story of what happened, who they are, who they were. And Ansel lies and says that he's an American. And they say, and the captain of the, I think it was the Indispensable, says, "Well, where's your captain?" Because that's the first question. What happened to your captain? And they say, "Our captain and two other men are on that island over there, and they've been gone for quite a while." And the captain of the Indispensable got very suspicious because the island was only 10 miles away. Why would they have been gone so long? And he began to suspect foul play. So he put the two men back on the island. He says, "If you killed your captain, I'm leaving you here." Well, Barnard and the others, while they're hunting and going up this hillside, they see the two ships turning into New Ireland, and they're just overcome with joy, and they're rolling on the ground and they're screaming, and Scent is all worried what's going on, and he's licking them and checking them to make sure everything's okay. And the weather is a little bit bad, the surf, so they have to wait until the afternoon, but they push off, they go to the ships. Barnard explains what happened. He doesn't throw Ansel under the bus. He says, "All my men were good to me," because that's the first thing that a captain will ask another captain. "Were your men good?" Because a lot of mutinies at this time, another foul play. "Were your men good to you?" And if they weren't, there would be some punishment. But if they were, everything was fine. And Barnard did not throw Ansel under the bus. He said, "Fine, they were all good. They're good people." And that was the beginning of this long, circuitous journey back home, because this is the age of sail. They don't have telephones. And these two British whaling ships were not going to stop their voyage because they picked up these Americans who had been marooned. They actually knew about it. They didn't stop there for this reason, but the British had been so upset about what happened to these Americans that they had been left behind, that a letter had been sent to British commanders throughout South America that if you ever have a ship that's going to go near the Falkland Islands, try to stop by New Ireland and see if you could find these five hunters who were left behind. So the captain of the Indispensable actually had that letter, but that's not why he went there. He totally forgot about it. So it's just a good coincidence. So they split up. Some of the men go on the Indispensable, some of the men go on the Asp, and then they have to continue with them on their whaling voyage.
It's like the twists and turns and the story keeps going. And that's not the end of it, because then you've got the question of the prize, the Nanina. Who does it belong to?
The Nanina and the Nancy left the Falklands in the summer of 1813. They go to Buenos Aires and Rio de Janeiro, and ultimately there are some of the Americans on board the Nanina. When it gets to Rio de Janeiro, complain to the local American consul and to the local British commander. And the local British commander, this guy Dixon, is very sympathetic. And he thinks that the way the Duranda had treated the Americans and had captured the Nanina as a prize is despicable. And he wants to try to broker a way to give the ship back to Valentine, who's there, who's one of the people that left with the Nanina and the Nancy. but there are some problems in negotiation. And ultimately, Dixon throws up his hands and says, fine, send the Nanina back to London. Let a court determine whether this is a valid prize. So that's happening. That court case, the decision in that court case actually comes down, amazingly enough, on the very day that the Americans, the five Americans on New Island, are rescued by the Asp and the Indispensable. But the war is still raging. So it's not until the Treaty of Ghent is signed and ratified in early 1815 that John Murray and son send one of the Murrays over to London to argue their case. And they arrived just in time because originally the prize had been awarded to Durandra. But then there was a year in which anybody could come and appeal that prize determination. Well, Murray arrived days before that year was up and met with local barristers and had a summary judgment made in a civil court where the judge said, there's been a great wrong done here. You need to appeal this right away. And they did appeal it. And the wheels of justice turned slowly. It was a few years later, but ultimately John Murray and Sons got the value of the Nanina and its cargo back. And British warship captain William Durandra was left with nothing. And he was very bitter and he complained about it for the rest of his life.
Yeah. And, you know, you can imagine Valentine, Charles' father, he probably never dreamed he'd ever see his son again.
Oh, yeah. Nobody thought they'd ever see these people again. They thought it was, in fact, when he left, when he was basically taken hostage by the British on the Nanina and they were sailing to Eagle Island, he essentially said, this is a death sentence if you leave these people behind in the midst of winter. And so everybody was very surprised.
Okay.
Later.
It read like a movie. Has anybody approached you to make a movie out of this yet?
Well, the book just came out.
Well,
that would be wonderful if somebody did, but I'm not in control of that. But you're certainly not the first person to say that.
No,
many people have said, this sounds like a movie.
You can picture it, right?
I'm all in. If somebody wants to make a movie about this, I'm all in.
All right, good to know. You've got a whole bunch of talks coming up. You've got on June 17th, you're going to be in Barnstable, June 27th at the Mashpee Library, June 27th at the Eldridge Public Library. You've got some others later in the summer, and we'll post a link with all of your talks and book signings at our website, capeandislands.org. Eric, always fun to talk to you. Always have these great adventures that you write about. Always fun.
Great. Oh, thanks again for having me back. It was fun.
Eric J. Dolan's new book, Left for Dead, Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.